This episode of The Biggest Table is brought to you in part by Wild Goose Coffee. Since 2008, Wild Goose has sought to build better communities through coffee. And for our listeners, Wild Goose is offering a special promotion of 20% off a one-time order using the code TABLE at checkout. To learn more and to order coffee, please visit wildgoosecoffee.com. In this episode, Andy Root and I explore the intersection of faith, spiritual formation, and community in the modern age. We delve into discussions of encountering God in a secular world, the transformative power of shared meals and ministry, the challenges faced by church leaders, and the significance of fostering genuine faith encounters and human connections. Enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Biggest Table. I am your host, Andrew Camp. In this podcast, we explore the table, food, eating, and hospitality as an arena for experiencing God's love and our love for one another. And today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Andy Root. Andy is the Carrie Olson Bailson Professor of Youth and Family Ministry at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And lately, his work has centered around the intersection of faith and our secular age, having just completed his 6-volume series, Ministry in a Secular Age. Although I should note, you mentioned at the beginning this was only going to be 3 volumes. It turned into 6. But he has also written a number of books and has given lectures and presentations across the country and globe, both to church groups, universities, colleges, youth workers, and academic communities. He lives in St. Paul, Minnesota, where his wife, Kara, is a Presbyterian minister, and they have 2 kids and a dog. And when he's not teaching and writing, he watches a ton of TV, he says. So thanks for joining me today, Andy. It's a privilege to get to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. So yeah, you did just finish this 6-volume series. And so I'm going to start by asking a question that's probably unfair. But for our listeners, Do you have like a 2-minute elevator pitch of what this work has centered around?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. I would say probably people would say what it's been about is a dialogue with Charles Taylor and a couple other thinkers, but mainly Charles Taylor. I think that's fair. I also get a little uncomfortable with that because I don't think it's really a kind of commentary on Charles Taylor or in any way. But there has been a lot of conversations with Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age, and some of the themes he has. But really what the project's been about is really trying to imagine how it is as we sit here in late modernity, in the third decade of the 21st century, how it is that we encounter the presence of a living God, and how faith communities and churches and pastors can have a vision for that and have an imagination for that. That's really what ultimately all 6 of them are about.
Right. And you mentioned through Charles Taylor that we're living in this sort of secular 3 age, where the world is flattened and there is no room, I guess you could say, for the transcendence or the breakthrough. Is that sort of, am I getting that correctly?
Yeah, I think very much so. That that book particularly is essentially an argument that says what you think is secular is not really what's secular. You know, that we usually tend to think what secular means is that fewer and fewer people are going to church, and that may be an empirical fact. I mean, I think we've seen that across the continent of Europe, and we've seen that obviously in we've seen it accelerate just in the last few decades here in the States, where fewer and fewer people are connected to faith communities. But really what he wants to point to is that's not actually really what it means to be living in a secular age. When you live in a secular age, you live in a time where all our forms of belief become quite fragile, and we're aware we could be believing something else, or that we may even believe something else a year or two from now, like that all of our beliefs are until further notice. And this becomes, part of the conditions of what it means. But it also means that having a kind of imagination where there's a living act of God, where transcendence is just built into our lives, becomes more and more unbelievable to people, not as even a direct rejection, but it just happens, that we live in a society where people can say things like, I'm taking a break from God for a while. And the fact that that's illogical, and we're like, don't think that's the weirdest thing you've ever heard, shows that we're in a very different epoch, that this is a very different kind of time. Because if you said that in the 14th century or in the 8th century or in the 8th century BC, people would have just been like, what does that even mean? How is that even possible? But we find it very plausible that you could even believe in God and take a break from God, and just decide you're going to live your life without thinking about God much. And that's what it means to live in this kind of secular age.
Yeah. No, and that's great. Because then there's also this push then for authenticity, yeah, where we're trying to discover our true self, which is why we can say we're taking a break from God, because we want to be authentic to our experience of life. But you even mentioned that, you know, that life can't operate in this flattening of reality, that the age of authenticity pushes us to find meaning in all sorts of different activities.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what your last book, you know, brings together of what different memoirs and people, where they find activities.
Yeah.
So how is it that then, even though a deniability of God can be plausible, we still are finding this bumping up against something for more in life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the interesting thing about us human creatures. And what I do take from Charles Taylor is that what it means to be a human being is to have to believe in something. That, you know, to be a human being, you are a moral believing animal, you know, and so you believe there's some way to live well, and that usually, well, whatever will shape your good life, you hold to it. You're committed to it. You take faith in it. So what's changed for us is we're not so sure you have to have God in that. You don't have to necessarily believe in God to live well. But we do think you have to deeply live well, that becomes very important. And I think one of the things that happens for us, which is, you know, I think really powerful in our time, is that our own selves and the project of our own selves starts to bear that weight of ultimacy for us. You know, so it isn't outside in the rituals or the symbols of a religion or a society that creates itself around forms of beliefs and forms of rituals and symbols, but it becomes the kind of internal life of ourselves, you know. So there's a kind of shift, like you visit Italy, or, you know, you go to the you go to Jerusalem and visit, you know, some of these old Byzantine churches that are there, you know, and you see these really intricate outer spaces. And now for us late moderns, and really it's been the whole of the modern project, we turn the intricate space from what's in the building out there into our own, the kind of textures of our own inner life. So people then can take a break from God, but they can never take a break from trying to find some significant thing that they're holding to that shapes their lives. So in our time, I think particularly the self, and being an interesting self, being a creative self, being a singularly unique self that can win recognition from others and admiration from others, becomes a way of infusing your life with purpose and meaning, and in some ways shaping your life symbolically and in a ritualized way, but it becomes very much about how you continue to kind of win in the project of yourself.
There's always this push for more and this desire, the accumulation of more resources for the self. And so then what does that then do to the Christian faith, and how has this infiltrated the church and maybe even wreaked havoc on our faith in this new age?
Yeah, well, I mean, it definitely has given us a different ways of thinking about what a human life is. There's no doubt about that. You know, this kind of sense that we're on a project of ourself, I think, is pretty formative to how we think about it. But it does, I think, you know, you had mentioned this earlier, that we all are authenticity seekers now, that in every way we're kind of trying to seek an authentic way of being a self, you know, that finds its way within the church. And that's not all bad in itself, you know, like, and Charles Taylor himself doesn't think that authenticity is a bad pursuit necessarily, but it does make things different. It makes them, you know, radically different. And I think the way that this ultimately filters into the church is another concept he uses that I find really informative and helpful, is that we just tend to encounter our world through what he says is an immanent frame. So we presume immanence over transcendence. Like the kind of lens we look at the world through tends to presume more natural and material answers to things than kind of supernatural ones. Now, what's fascinating about that is you ask most people, do they believe in ghosts, or do they believe in spirits, or, you know, do they believe in even, you know, something after death? And they will say they do. But it's fascinating how it doesn't really shape people's lives that directly. You know, like, it's really hard to get late modern middle class people to commemorate publicly commemorate the death of a loved one or to remember an uncanny spiritual experience that they have. You know, it's almost like people are willing to tell those stories when they're telling ghost stories, you know, one late night with friends, you know, around dessert or something. But it doesn't seem to shape people's lives as directly as it would have if you were, say, a medieval person or something, where if someone in your village had an experience of the transcendent or saw an angel in the woods, you would commemorate that. You would make a kind of ritual remembrance, some kind of commemoration in stone or something to remember that. And we tend not to do that as modern people. So these experiences we even have of a kind of transcendence as a kind of fullness, they get just kind of flattened by immanence.
Right. And this is where it gets so tricky, because if you talk to most pastors, I don't think they would say they're denying the transcendent, because they're saying, we baptize people, we celebrate the Lord's table. But it feels different. And yet how do you push, because it feels like there's a very fine line, like it's not a neat demarcation that we can make, but there does feel like the loss of transcendence is important. So how do you even talk to pastors then? Because I don't think many pastors would say that, yes, we're denying the transcendence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the way I would respond to that is I don't think intellectually or directly any of us, or most of us, would refuse a kind of transcendent referent. But it is fascinating to think about, as we lead our churches, what sets the terms for what we think is a good church? Like, what does a good church look like? Or what does good pastoral ministry look like? And it is so easy, I think, inside of this kind of secular age and some other forces that are going on within it, for us to think what a good church is has something to do with what you said earlier. Like, it has an abundance of resources and a bunch of cultural relevance. And for myself as a pastor, one might think, the good pastor is the one who has a significant reach out beyond the world with, with books or, some kind of writings or a podcast or whatever. And what it means to do good ministry has something to do with these realities. So I don't think anyone maybe directly thinks I don't think anyone under their breath is saying when they do the words of institution over the elements, this is BS. I don't think there's most people that do that. But it is just really quite amazing how easy it is to kind of just let other goods replace that. Or, what's the purpose? Does being the person who kind of oversees and gives the sacraments to this community, does that radiate enough meaning to keep you doing this? So the question just becomes, and this is where I think all six volumes have tried to go, maybe break ground, maybe not, but has tried to really articulate, how is it that us late modern people, where is it? What's the shape of how we encounter what I call divine action, or the act of God in the world? And I think to me that becomes the real challenge of how to keep that as the primary objective of ministry and congregational life. How do I help these people encounter the presence of a living God, not how do I build a seawall against all the decline that's out there? Or how do I even look in the mirror when, this church a decade and a half ago had X amount of people and now it has, 15, 20, 30% less? And why is that how do I not take complete blame for that, and trying to point to these deeper realities that are at play?
Right. And yet we're trapped in this resource accumulation mode, that to actually break through that, and having been in the evangelical world and up until recently, the machine is so hard to stop, just because so much depend, my salary was dependent on people's giving, we think, we set goals and goals are good, but when those goals are number focused, we get lost, it feels, at times in that. We lose sight of the ministry that we're called to.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just a deep temptation for everything we do to become instrumentalized, so we even think caring for people walking them through death or a cancer diagnosis, we think like, what do we get out of this? Like, how do we turn this into more? And what we mean tend to mean by more is like more resources, more relevance, instead of just the sacredness of what it means to live with these people, what it means to prepare them to die, what it means to take them into the scriptures, to commune with God in the midst of these moments. There's just this deep temptation. And I guess in a kind of late modern capitalist system, but, you know, just really the modern project is that the way you stabilize yourself is through certain kind of logics of escalation. You need to kind of keep escalating things. You need to grow things. You need to get more out of those. And that does have the acidic kind of rebound effect of turning all of our encounters with people into some kind of trying to parlay them into some kind of ends. And we lose the beauty and the gift of what it means to really encounter and minister and live with.
Yeah. No, and that, so then I would love to transition then to actually what then faith looks like for you in this project, because you talk that faith becomes sort of a lived death experience of Jesus, to paraphrase, maybe, like in that about a death experience, it's about waiting. So what is it about the death experience and waiting that seems important in this secular age?
Yeah, I mean, really what goes through all three books is there is a sense of what we need. And people will respond, like even your listeners right now will kind of have an aversion to this. But what we need is a kind of disposition of passivity. We need to be put in a place, in ministry is inviting people into a place of receiving, of particularly receiving a gift that is outside them, to them. So the whole series kicks off, like you were just saying, with a real trying. I mean, it really kicks off a conversation about Charles Taylor, because I was really confused on how faith was being defined at the practical level when we kind of thought about passing on faith, what we meant by that, or even the measures of the state of kind of Protestant faith in America. It always seemed like the definitions of faith were taken over from sociologists. And that isn't to throw any shade on sociologists, other than to say sociologists, by disciplinary demand, have to count things. So there was always kind of reports on participation. And you can see how this becomes what Taylor is afraid is the wrong definition of the secular, which is fewer and fewer people are participating. So we know Protestantism is in bad shape in America, because we've seen, you know, a 12, 13, 15% drop in participation. And like I said earlier, that's important. I mean, that's really important. And we should learn from that. And we should be very thankful for sociologists who have methods who can tell us those things. But what I was seeing was a one-to-one correlation of that being what we meant by faith. Like, you know, the state of faith in America, in Protestantism in America, is in bad place because, you know, people used to go to church three times a month and now they're going less than two. Isn't that awful? I thought, man, that's just a really bizarre way of defining faith. And Paul would never define it that way, if you want to go with Paul. But Paul for sure would not see it that way. And so what Paul thinks faith is something quite radical. He thinks that it is the fact that he no longer lives, but Christ lives in him. And the life he lives in the body, he lives in faith. You know, so there's this deep sense of, I mean, to use a big philosophical word, there's a deep sense of an ontological participation. Like, you are in the being of Christ. And this is the imminent frame at play again. Like, we have even the hardest time thinking, what does that even mean? Right. Like, what would it mean for my being to be in something else? I like, we have nothing that kind of can think about that, where maybe more ancient people, more medieval people would have, like, that can kind of make sense, how something, how an infinite and a finite can participate in each other. But for us, that's really hard. But that seems to be where Paul is going. And what does seem to then connect with us or be able to get us back into that kind of ontological language is that as our real lived experiences of loss and brokenness, and when those are confessed and shared in and ministered to human person to human person, there is a spiritual dynamic. And, you know, so I try to draw out the story of Paul and Ananias in Acts 9, in that really it's Paul's confession of his death experience, that on the road to Damascus, he loses everything. He loses his whole story. And in the midst of kind of that experience of losing your story, that death experience, he finds a new story, and that new story is the very life of Jesus Christ. And that seems to be faith, where our very identities, our very senses of of our own being, that we confess that they're in Christ. We have this kind of transformational experience. And I don't know any other way of talking about this kind of ontological depth for us modern people than to actually talk about death, you know, to mm-hmm. talk about, and I mean death in the capital D way, like, you know, you're going to die, but also in this way of just loss and grief and brokenness. And my big kind of overall theological dynamic is that the way this God acts, this God of Israel, this God made known in Jesus Christ, is that this God takes what is alive, takes what is dead and makes it alive. This God takes what's dead and makes it alive. And so faith in really is this deep sense of turning over our deaths to God to stop, to be put in a point of passivity, but then to receive something in it and to receive the most profound thing that's quite, you know, First and Second Corinthians, backwards and foolish, but that backwards and foolishness is the bringing forth of life right out of death, and that this is a God who brings resurrection, but resurrection through a cross, like through the confession of the cross, which is why Paul says, "I choose to know only Christ and Him crucified," because in confessing the experiences of the cross, there becomes the dynamic, the actuality of the encounter of God bringing life out of it, of the community participating in that. So that's really where I'm kind of going. So waiting becomes a way of being together as persons and attending to God's stories and really attending to our stories of loss and death and turning them over to God.
Wow. Yeah. And that passivity, that receiving, as I read your work, that's where I was beginning to wonder the space for the table, you know, and
yeah.
One, it starts obviously, you know, every Sunday as we gather around the Lord's table, because we receive death, you know, yeah. remembering Christ's yeah. death, you know, and it's, I have a big thing that we never take communion. We always need to receive it just because I think it fights against, you know, just a one word fights against this consumeristic mind for the taking, accumulation. But where does then the Eucharist or the Lord's table, then how do you see that operating within this project?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to how you said it just there. One of the interesting things I think about kind of the work I've done, maybe in relation to others who have worked with Charles Taylor, is I tend to be more of a personalist than a like taking a liturgical turn. You know, there's been a other perspectives that have kind of said that the way we respond to this kind of reductive kind of secular age is that we have to return to a kind of liturgies that open us up, that re-enchant the world maybe in some ways, or at least kind of reform us and give us different visions. And in some ways, that's where Charles Taylor would be. I am, at the end of the day, my kind of theological spiritual animal is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you know. So Bonhoeffer's kind of perspective that the concreteness of revelation, the real encounter with God's presence happens with persons and relationship, is a central dynamic for me. So I okay. think the way beyond this, again, is the death experience becomes the kind of openness, the event, the receiving of other person. So Bonhoeffer says this about, you know, he's a good Lutheran, and he definitely believes that the sacramental dynamics of communion particularly, but also baptism, are significant. But he also reminds us that when we take communion, it's always our brother or sister who gives it to us. It's always a human yeah. person who shares it with us. So there is something truly powerful about the elements themselves, that that Jesus Christ, His real presence is in the bread and the wine, under, around, beside, is there. But there also, you can never give yourself communion. Like even when we were in the pandemic, when we took it, I mean, it gets a little fuzzy when you're doing it as a recorded service, but we took it together, even if we weren't together, like we took it together through Zoom or whatever. Right. You know, you can't baptize yourself. And in the same way, you can't give yourself the elements, you know, you have to have some way of, like you're saying, receiving it. I think that's a huge piece of it, that you have to enter into what Bonhoeffer would say is person structure, a structured reality where persons are present. It's often why in a lot of traditions the confession of sin happens before it, the kind of surrendering of the confession of what it means to be a human being happens before it. So for me, really, even in this kind of more personalist vein, a sacramental dynamic runs throughout all my work, in the sense that I'm really interested and think the church needs to be more focused on the sacramental than the kind of participatory, if you will, like the way the sacramental sense of how the divine and the human, the infinite and the finite participate is a much more generative reality to focus on than how do we kind of build institutional structures. Not that it's mutually exclusive. We still have to think about roof leaks and you know, budgets and things like that. It would be completely naive to not hold to those things. But it's amazing how we get our imaginations sucked in one direction. And so I want a very broad, open kind of sacramental perspective. So the table itself is of utter importance, but the table always radiates out to how we're sent in the world to care for persons. And so we come and share this meal as a way of sharing Jesus Christ's death to be renewed, to receive, but then go into the world and participate in others' death experiences, become Ananias to Paul in many ways. And we need the table to do that. And then we bring people back to the table too, as in many ways, you know, Ananias brings Paul back to the table, which is also a risky thing. You know, they're all like, what's this guy who's, we got intel, he's here to kill us. And now here he is taking this meal. And yet it is a meal that does turn enemies into friends, that does, because we all share in the being of Christ through doing this.
So then as we take communion, you know, you love it how you said it's, you know, to motivate us or to send us out into the world as ministers, then how does then the table not become a place of re-enchantment, but a place of deep relationality, which is, I think, yeah, what you're calling us to is a deeper relationality with each other. How then can our home tables, our tables in our neighborhood be used as an avenue for this?
Yeah, well, this is the beauty of the table, in that the table, I'll just put it this way. We have a son, our oldest son is now a freshman in college. And so we're discovering, and our youngest is a junior in high school. And there's just, maybe this is just us as parents. I don't know if other listeners have this experience, but like late teenagers, you know, like late high school kids, getting them to sit down at the table with you is nearly impossible, you know, like, and then we would demand it from our son particularly. And then he'd like, because of the way school was, he would eat before, like he had to eat at like 3:30 because he was starving. And then when we would eat at 6, he wouldn't be hungry. So then he would sit there and not eat. And so we'd have these like arguments, like first of all, you have to sit down with us and eat. And then secondly, like, it's really weird for you to watch us eat. Like, you need to eat something too. And so I'd always make these speeches on how human civilizations and connections are built towards eating together, you know? But what is really fascinating is how we've lost that. And that makes sense inside of this kind of secular age, unfortunately, is that in such a kind of accelerated time, and the other major dialogue partner, at least descriptively for me in this project, is a German thinker named Hartmut Rosa. And he really thinks what it means to be modern is to be in this kind of constant state of speeding up and even trying to stabilize our institutions and our own individual lives by going faster, by growing, by accelerating and accumulating, that just seems to be the way that we stabilize ourselves. And when that happens, the table must become efficient. The table no longer becomes a place to linger in personhood and hear stories and tell jokes and laugh together and cry together. It becomes a place to get people fed and get people on. Like, you need to eat because, you know, you won't be able to do good work if you're eating. But the point is, get through and move on. So the elementary school my kids went to, they would eat lunch in 20 minutes. It was 20 minutes. And this is Minnesota. So during the winter, they would, if they wanted to have recess, so if they wanted 15-minute recess, they had to eat lunch in like 10 minutes. And they had to eat lunch with their coat on so that they could then get out of there. Right. And I partly understand, like, getting smaller kids in coats and mittens is awful. Yeah. But I always thought, like, if the French heard we were doing this, they would go crazy. You know, like, the kind of cultural sense of what it means to eat and the linger in a meal and to taste, and that we've lost that in this kind of sense of acceleration. So I think there's something incredibly prophetic and profound about a table in the world where we invite persons to be in it. and to hear each other's stories and to tell jokes and to essentially waste time together, which is, of course, never wasted. But it really is an experience of feeling connected, that a table is an invitation where enemies are made into friends because it becomes non-instrumental. It becomes a place where if you come to my table, you are my friend. And the point of our connection is to be together, not to be something else, to close a deal or something like that, you know. Right. And now we kind of feel like every meal really is needs to be a lecture to kids, or it needs to be closing a business deal, or it needs to be something like that, instead of it just being the invitation to linger in each other's being more than having to accomplish something.
No, for sure. Or, you know, we turn it into the performance, you know, whether in our homes, if hospitality looks has to look a certain way, or dining out becomes a...
This meal gets 5 stars. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The experience, you know, and I think there is a place for that, because I think food and what great chefs are doing is just like great art, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But it again, it's putting it in its right place versus using it as a means of an experience, you know, and seeing it as a tool for resonance or transcendence. Versus a place where the food becomes transcendent.
And a good meal with all the art behind it is something only persons can do, you know. Like I guess that would be an interesting thing. Like, do we ever create robots who can become our chefs? Or do you need a certain human dynamic to really share in a meal? And is that one of our, whether it's fair or not, one of our kind of pushes away of fast food, is that there's not enough humanity in it, you know, that it's too fast. It's too, assembly line made, and there's not this sense of craft to it, this sense of being in it. So yeah, I think there's something about food that's really important, and you can see a kind of renewing of people being really interested in food, because I think it is a kind of counter current to this acceleration we feel.
And so then we're, you know, as we're thinking about this personhood and sharing in each other's personhood, what I love about Rosa's work is his idea that, you know, this resonance is something we long for, but we can never create.
Yeah.
And so I think it's something too with faith that we long for these moments with persons and sharing in their personhood, but it's not something we can actually manufacture. Which is really a hard space to sit in, because it's like, well, then what do I do? Like, because there's a bad passivity, but then there's the good passivity you're calling us to. So like, how do we embrace this tension then, knowing that ultimately we're waiting for something we can't control?
Yeah. And this is just the problem of being a modern person, you know, like, modernity in itself is, for good reasons, actually trying to control the world, you know. Like, it's good, it keeps people alive that we can control the temperature in houses with air conditioning or with heat. It's great to have roads that can control the travel to get up into the mountains and, you know, to see these beautiful things. Like, these are all good forms of control, but it ends up turning on us and everything becomes instrumentalized again. And there is something that I think we do know, that our most profound transformational experiences are almost always, like 99.9% of the time, uncontrollable. If you try to control them, especially with human persons, you know, if you think like, okay, this meal, we are going to connect, we're going to come out of this, they're never going to forget this. Usually it's the exact opposite. Like, it just does not go that way. But you can, I mean, there's things we can do. We can't control it. You cannot manufacture an experience, as Rosa calls it, of resonance. It is uncontrollable. That's one of its major dynamics. But you can create semi-controlled experiences. And that's what the table is. That if we have good food, if we have a kind of attentiveness to one another, if we can have conversation, there's a possibility that maybe the conditions will be right for the kind of connection that brings resonance. But if you say it's got to happen, and we're not leaving this table until everyone has an experience of resonance, you'll never get it. There's got to be freedom in the midst of it. There's got to be a kind of openness. But we can know having kids eat lunch with their jackets on and telling them they have 8 minutes to eat their lunch. If they want to have the resonance of going outside and playing for 15 minutes, you can almost guarantee that will never be an experience of resonance. You know, that will never, ever happen. So if we want that, then we have to create these spaces where there's time, where there's maybe good food, where the smell, where the light is a certain way. And then we have to have the humility, in some sense, a holy apathy to be like, well, does this mean we'll get it? I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it will, maybe not. But we know for sure it will never happen if we're saying, keep your jacket on, you know, eat. Open it up out of this package, eat it. You have 30 seconds to eat that and 1 minute to eat that. And then we're going to push you through. It will never happen. So there is an invitation of putting ourselves in a posture of receiving resonance, but that's all we can really do. But that is spiritual formation in itself, you know, is to invite people into a posture. And I really like Rosa because I working from a certain theological tradition that's trying to remind us that God is God. We cannot control God. The pastor can never promise with a sermon, with any kind of part of congregational life that they know that, you know, she could promise God will show up now. No. Then you're not talking about God. You're talking about some religious product you're trying to sell. God is God. And what we can do, however, in what the classic Christian practices and forms of prayer and reading scripture teach us to do is to put ourselves into a posture of attentiveness to how this God acts and moves and to wait for it. And I think that's what happens at a table too, you know, with a family or with friends, is just to set the conditions to wait for it. But you will never get to friendship if you're like, after this meal, we're all going to be good friends. We're going to be best friends. You almost guarantee that people are going to be like, that dude is very controlling. And let's not have dinner with that person again, you know?
No, for sure. But and that's where, you know, I think I feel the weight as somebody who has been a pastor, or, you know, even with a small group, like you want these experiences to be formative. And so you have expectations, and then and so you can't be a human without expectations, it feels like. And so to as we think about being spiritual and meeting and connecting and longing for this God who wants to invade our lives, like, to just tell people to wait feels really hard.
Yeah.
You know, because people want, like, they're after the next experience. So, it's that fear that they're going to go find it elsewhere if we don't give them the good.
Yes, absolutely. And I do tell people, like, when I tell you the answer to a lot of this is to wait and to wait on God, though I do want to remind them, like, the church starts. We think the church starts in Acts 2. Like, that's what we think. That's the Pentecost experience. Yeah. And we particularly, as late modern people, love the text, the verse in that text of Pentecost where it says, and thousands were added to their number. We're like, that just feels delicious to us. But that's really not the first command. That's not really where the church starts. The church starts in the command of Jesus to the men on the road to Emmaus to return to Jerusalem and to wait. The first command is to wait. Now, as late modern people, especially those of us who've lived in a consumer society, we're told that waiting is the worst thing ever. You know, like, in many ways, what our economy tries to do, particularly the consumer part of our economy, is to take all the waiting out of wanting, you know? So your Amazon droid is coming soon to drop off, you know, your package. If we can get that time down, you know, that's all the better. So I understand there is negative waiting. Some waiting just is really awful. Right. I just got an update on my watch for a different Apple Watch. And for some dumb reason, I told the guy to pair my watch in the store. He's like, do you want to have it paired now or do you want to take it home? So let's pair it now. And so getting on the Apple Store Wi-Fi, they had to do a software update. And it was the most excruciating wait ever, as watching the bar of the download. And it was a busy store and the bandwidth was all eaten up. And then I was like 30% in. I'm like, do I abort this or do I stick with it? And then I'm 70% in. It was awful. There was nothing spiritual. There was nothing humanizing about this kind of waiting. Waiting for a software update is just brutal. There's no resonance in it. But that's not the waiting I think we're after. The kind of waiting we're after is really a lot like what you're trying to do with the table, which is to come and to eat and to laugh and to be together and to live together in this way. And so I think the waiting is really to stop thinking, again, we have to parlay this into something. Like the point of us eating together is because if we eat together, then this will become a membership program. And then we'll be able to build a kind of laddered tiered pyramid system out of this. And so that's why we got to do this, because then look at, we'll be able to get all these returns. No, there's goods in just being together and laughing and just seeing each other's humanity. And that's enough in many ways.
Wow, that's beautiful, and it's hard, and it's a challenge.
So hard, yeah.
So how, as you've written these six volumes, like how has your faith then changed? You know, what does faith then look like for you now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at its most direct, it is really living in a small community like this. You know, my wife is a Presbyterian pastor in a small city church in South Minneapolis. And I mean, in some ways, these books have, to be slightly reductive, these books have been a way of really articulating and justifying the ministry she does. And it is not, I always get kind of uncomfortable telling people about that, because then they're like, oh, there's so much church tourism. People are like, oh, I'd love to come check this church out when I'm in Minneapolis. And you're like, if you come and check it out, you will be so unimpressed. I mean, it is just a little community of just ordinary people. And you really could never understand the depth of it until you were in it for 6 months or for a year. You're not going to go away and be like, wow, that was so different. But there is a sense of what it means to inhabit a certain kind of way of being, and to really be with each other around experiences of death and yearnings and loss, and what it means to try to reach for resonance and connection and not kind of acceleration. So it's watching that has been deeply, deeply transformational. And I think it's also been really transformational to think about, especially the last two volumes of the book, about how the kind of performance of the self is such a tantalizing temptation in our time, you know. So it's a hard to thread the needle of like being on your podcast or being on any podcast or writing a book and hoping people read it and not be kind of on social media talking about myself all the time or trying to win people's attention, and knowing that that's really spiritually acidic. Like how to think of, how do I honor these books and give them a chance to live, but how do I continue to remember daily that this is not about me? Like this is me offering this back. This is not about myself. Obviously me, I'm in it. Like, you know, you can't disconnect my humanity from these books. But the point is really to try to encourage people to seek for Christ and Him crucified and not think that I'm super clever. And so, you know, like, how do you do that in a publishing world where like, you've got to have a social media, platform. You have to have a growing social media impact and not be, you know, like out there saying, this is what I'm eating for lunch. And, oh, I had this really interesting experience. And this person emailed me and told me I was super cool and loved my book. Like, how do you, like the humble brag, how do you avoid that? And, so it's made me more aware of those realities and how to kind of confess those vulnerabilities and live in those.
Thank you for sharing that. As we begin to wrap up, it's a question I love asking, and you've sort of hinted at it, but I'd love to hear a summary. As you think then about the church and look at the church, let's stick with America, right? Because that's what we know. What's the story you would love the church to tell?
Yeah, that is a really great question. Well, I would answer it two ways. When it comes to the leaders of the church, what I would want, the story I want pastors particularly to tell themselves is that it's a little bit of a Goodwill Hunting kind of, which is one of my favorite movies, is a little bit, it's not your fault. And it's not your fault to get you off the hook and even to justify kind of real lazy or uninspired ministry. But it is to say there are huge cultural currents that have shifted here. And so you can't think that, I think a lot of us were told, especially coming out of conservative Protestantism in the 90s or whatever, like we were going to save the church. We were the hope. And then it's been really hard 3 decades, you know, of the 21st century. And it's really easy to feel like it's my fault. Like I wasn't creative enough. Like I blew it. Look at those other people who are making such a bigger impact. And I want to release pastors from that. Mm-hmm. And I also want then I guess there's a little bit of a judgment here, is like to repoint them to the absolute depth and beauty of ministry, to not think that there's something more profound than ministry itself, that walking with people as they live and as they die, just, you know, use the kind of perspective of this podcast to set the table for people, both literally and figuratively, is an incredible privilege and is an amazing thing. And that ministry seems utterly powerless, you know, compared to other forms of human action like law or entrepreneurship or politics or, you know, celebrity. All those forms of human action seem more powerful, but it just could be in its absurdity that ministry is the most powerful form of human action. It looks weak. It will always need to be weak, but it's the only form of human action that participates in death and has life come out of it. That's a profound form of action, that life comes out of death in this form of action. So I want to encourage leaders, both lay leaders and kind of pastoral leaders, that there's something utterly beautiful in the practice of ministry. And so the story I want the church to live out of is that in this moment, the crisis we face is not the crisis of decline. We're in a tough moment. There's no doubt about it. That's not the story that should keep us up at night. The story or the crisis that should keep us up at night is how do we create space, sit at a table together again, and be able to listen for the speaking of a living God? How do we form communities that are attentive and in a posture to hear God speak again, God move again? And how do we become aware of that? Because I think this God is acting and moving. How do we do that? And how do we live in the crisis of a God who is God that we cannot control? That's a story that should keep us up at night, keep us wondering, keep us wrestling with, not the story of we don't have enough. How do we get more? How do we parlay this into more gains? Again, it's not being naive. Some of that stuff really matters. But I do not think we'll be able to get to a point of even stabilizing our institutional structures until we have a kind of opening up to a deeper theological realities. And I don't think one can feed the other. In other words, I do not think being concerned just about the crisis of decline and the crisis of lost resources will ever get us to the depth of theology we need to get to. But maybe really attentively asking the question, where is Jesus Christ? How are we faithful to Jesus Christ? How do we live out of this story? Will put us in a position that the church institutionally will be okay. But we go the other direction all the time, I think.
Wow. There's so much that you just said there that's probably worthy of unpacking, but we'll leave it there just because I think it is a great a challenge and an inspiration to all of us. And so as we end to a few fun questions, just, you know, to change the mood a little bit, that was a heavy moment, a beautiful moment. What's one food you refuse to eat?
Ooh, that is a really good question. What I refuse to eat is this is more information than anyone on here wants to know. I refuse to eat like a curry and like really Indian food, not because I don't like it, but because it doesn't sit well with my Northern European system, and it becomes a few days of problems. Let's just say that. Yep. Let's just say that I taught somebody took me to eat some great Indian food right before I taught an intensive class, and for the next few days that we took a lot of breaks.
Oh,
is that gotcha. More information?
Yeah.
You can edit that out if that's just disgusting.
Hey, no, I appreciate it. That's what this podcast is. Hey, we're setting the table, you know?
or needing to leave the table as it was. Yes, yeah. Right.
And so then what's the best thing you've ever eaten?
So one of the best things I ever had was in a restaurant in Rome, and it was like this pasta dish with this incredible sauce, and I like dreamt of it for months, and then got to take my family back there and went to this restaurant, had the same dish. I still found it to be amazing, and everyone else in my family was like, it's okay, and I was just gutted by that. I just couldn't believe it. So yeah, the best thing I've ever had is this pasta dish in Rome.
Nice. And then finally, there's a conversation amongst chefs about last meals, as in like, if you knew you had one last meal to enjoy, what would it be? So if you knew you had one last meal, do you know what you would have?
Yeah, I think I would have, like, is this like in a kind of dark situation, like that's my like death row last meal.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But from a Christian perspective, we can say you're going to meet Jesus, you know?
Okay. All right. I think I'd have surf and turf, like a really good steak, maybe with a lobster tail or something.
Nice.
Yeah, I think so.
Please tell me it's not a filet that you're going to have.
I don't know. It depends on how it's made, I think. I don't know.
Okay.
You're opposed to a filet?
I think fat is flavor. So I'm a ribeye New York steak guy. So like if I'm going to a steakhouse, I'm going that route versus
I would like to do it like a porterhouse. That would be
okay. That's fair.
Then you get a little filet with it, but you get you know.
That's, yeah.
So
okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Right. We can still be friends.
Okay. Okay. I took the political in between answer.
No, that's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, Andy, to do this with me. It's been a rich conversation. If people want to learn more about your work, is there a place they can find you?
Yeah. I mean, they can just go online and you'll find me there. But I have a website that's just andrewroot.org, which don't ask me why it's a .org, but it is. I'm not an organization, but, you know, maybe in my own mind I am. So you can find me there. And yeah, I'm also on that terrible cesspool called X or Twitter, but I rarely do anything on there other than follow people who are tweeting about my hockey team. So,
okay. Yeah. What's your hockey team?
The Minnesota Wild.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
And what TV show? You said you watch a lot of TV. Any good TV shows?
Yeah. What are we watching right now? So we're watching Constellation. That's on like three episodes in on Apple TV Plus. It's a little kind of like sci-fi space movie or space TV show. That's pretty good. That we'll see if it stays good. But we're watching that, and we did just finish True Detective, the most recent Jodie Foster season of True Detective, which we need a whole other podcast to talk about what I thought about the finale.
Gotcha.
So,
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks for joining us today on this episode of The Biggest Table, where we explore what it means to be transformed by God's love around the table and through food. Until next time, bye.